From asylums to community mental health to managed care, this hour, how our approach to treating mental illness has changed over the decades. Iowa Week continues here on River to River under the theme Then and Now. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, psychiatrist Dr. Michael Flaum takes us through the evolution of mental health care. And also, we'll hear from an Iowan who was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1979. Then, in the second half hour, the battle against childhood diseases over the decades. Pediatric Dr. Nate Price tells us about the great strides that have been made. We'll also hear from an Iowa polio survivor. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week on both of our talk shows this entire week. It's really a neat chance for us to pick up a theme and run with it in various scenarios. And our theme this week, if you were listening yesterday to Talk of Iowa, to River to River, or Talk of Iowa this morning when food was explored, then and now. Later in the hour, we'll explore how the battle against childhood diseases, infectious diseases, has changed over the decades. In this first half hour, that we want to get a sense of how mental health care has changed over the past few generations. So perhaps you have a personal story of mental illness that would demonstrate that, how it's changed, how the diagnosis and the treatment, perhaps societal attitudes have changed in reference to mental health. 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us this half hour, Dr. Michael Flaum is returning to our studio. We're so glad to have him, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa, former director of the Iowa Consortium for Mental Health. Welcome back to our studio, Dr. Flaum.
Thank you.
Give us a quick overview of the treatment, the approach towards mentally ill, and the logic behind the treatment. And if we can start back in the days of asylums, that's a big, scary word,
yes,
an archaic word. But when you do the research, it wasn't that long ago.
It really wasn't. It was within my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so your theme is then and now.
Yes.
We're looking at mental health then and now. So perhaps one way to sort of put a handle on this is to think that in my lifetime, there have been three federal commissions to look at the state of mental health in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of three times there was this effort to do a view from 30,000 feet. One was in the Kennedy administration. One was in the Carter administration, late 70s,
mm-hmm,
and one was in the second George Bush administration in the beginning part of this century.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about those times, so the Kennedy one was really signaled the end of what you just talked about, the asylum era, which had been kind of the standard practice for quite a while up until then. So what is that? Well, that is, if you have a serious enough mental illness that you can't hide it,
mm-hmm,
and you can't make it,
mm-hmm,
then we have an alternate society where you can spend the rest of your life.
Right. But you're using, actually, aren't you using a modern word, mental illness, to... It would have been described in other words in previous...
It might have been described as insanity or something like that.
Right, right.
But the idea was either you don't tell us about it, so stigma.
The family helps you hide it, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's real bad, then we got this other place where you can live out your life. And the big change in the 50s and 60s was this idea of, wait a second... maybe we should do things differently, and maybe we should approach these as illnesses like any other, and maybe they should be treated in the communities of people's choice. So there was the deinstitutionalization movement in which the asylums, every state in the country, had these asylums, and they started emptying out quite dramatically in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
To
be replaced by a new system, the community mental health system. Mm-hmm. Remember, Kennedy administration, this is a time of great prosperity in this country, great hope, great promise, and there was a wonderful vision. And all across this country, money was allotted for bricks and mortar to essentially build community mental health services to serve the entire population. And it was a wonderful idea. Now, that brings us to the Carter administration, late 70s, early 80s, when the economic prosperity in this country was very different. Things weren't looking quite as good. And the hope of sort of building that community mental health infrastructure was never fully realized in terms of the financing that it needed. And the death knell really came in the Reagan administration, and we're still feeling that today.
What happened in the Reagan administration?
Funding, at least from a federal level, for continuing to support the sustenance of this community mental health center infrastructure really got pulled out.
Mm-hmm. With the result of?
Well, that infrastructure has been functioning at a kind of a skeletal level ever since. It really has struggled to continue to meet the needs. Now, we've had great success in some ways in the anti-stigma movement, mm-hmm. so recognizing mental illnesses are out there. But with that comes increasing utilization of services, which should be a good thing. But our capacity to meet those needs has not kept up with the demand for services.
Can you put that in percentages? If you would look at today, say, how much of the need is being unmet?
Well, there are data that can address that. So there was a pretty good study done, maybe 8 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And every county in the country was assessed in terms of how much unmet need there was. And the results were fairly staggering. Over 75% of counties in this country appeared to have less than half of their needs met.
Mm.
Okay? And about 96% had some unmet needs. So this is not an Iowa situation. This is a national situation of much greater demand for services than availability. In Iowa, it's always been a bit more extreme, especially in terms of the mental health workforce. For example, psychiatrists we're usually ranked in the bottom five states in terms of the number of psychiatrists per capita.
Mm. Dr. Michael Flaum is with us as we talk about caring, understanding mental health then and now. He's kind of taking us up to the present. What is the last chapter?
So I would
here?
Say that the nadir was probably in the 80s, early 90s, and I think things have started turning around quite significantly, and that brings us to the latest commission, the Bush administration commission, called the New Freedom Commission. But I would say if you asked Rosalind Carter, people asked Rosalind Carter, they said, what's the biggest change in mental health between your commission mm-hmm. and this commission? And you know what she said? She said, we now recognize that recovery is possible for all people with mental illness. And that, to me, that's perhaps the most important change, which is this idea of what it means to be in recovery in mental illness. Now, it does not mean cure.
Recovered does not mean cured.
No. That term, as she was using it, and as it is commonly used, is not suggesting we can cure these illnesses, because in fact, sadly, what I would have to report is that our ability to cure mental illnesses has not really changed, or we don't do that much better of a job at it today than we did in the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
Our advances in our understanding of the brain have not yet translated into meaningfully better results in terms of cures. However, the real question, the interesting question is, what will it take for you as a patient with mental illness X, whatever that is, how will you thrive? Given the hand that you're dealt, and we are all dealt hands.
Yes.
You know, some of us talk about the hands that we're dealt and some of us don't. But given the cards that you're dealt, how are you going to play them? And what will it take for you to thrive? And that's really the focus these days. What can a meaningful life look like, even with someone with, say, a devastating, catastrophic mental illness? What will it take for them to thrive? That's the current thrust.
Dr. Michael Flaum is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. Steve Miller is with us as well. He's an Iowan diagnosed with a serious mental illness as we talk about how this has been treated over the decades. Steve Miller, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Your mental illness was diagnosed way back in 1979.
Yeah, it's so been a while.
It's sort of midstream in what Dr. Flaum was talking about in our evolving treatment of mental health care. Tell us, what were the symptoms that led to your diagnosis, and what was your diagnosis?
Yeah, and this is interesting. Michael brought up some really good points. Personally, yeah, we're talking about the then and the now. So you said, like you said, Ben, I got sick in 79 when I was 19 years old. The medications that we had then were actually developed around 1960. So that was the then. Then this new medication came out in 89. So I had 10 years of horrible, horrible life. Just, you wouldn't want to wish it on anybody.
Even with those medications?
Because those old medications were so ineffective that were designed earlier.
Tell me about your original symptoms so we can get a sense of your mental illness.
You know, I had recognition early on, you know, when I was a kid that there was something wrong. But my freshman year of college, I remember sitting in my dorm room one afternoon. I thought, you know, there's something wrong with me. I thought there was bugs crawling on me. I was nervous as heck and delusional, and it was starting to have some auditory hallucinations. So I went over to the infirmary on the campus, and it was closed. It was a Sunday. But I knew that there was something going on. I didn't know what it was, but I'd had enough psychology classes to have an idea that something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the then and the now. Now, as far as recovery goes, I'd like to talk just a little bit about that. Like Michael said, we never say we're recovered. We say we're in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And personally,
what does that mean for you personally?
Well, it means that there's hope, that there's been some good gains and some good movement made.
You look well. You're working in society. You're getting around. You came to the studio today, right? I mean,
does that surprise you?
No, I'm just saying it's part of living,
right?
Moving from one place to another.
Exactly.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. So I mean, I have a reason to get out of bed every day. I get out. I see people and. Do work and do good stuff and even doing this kind of thing, I think, is going to help people better understand mental health, because that's as far as my work goes, that's kind of my life is mental health stuff.
Dr. Flaum, when the newer medications mm-hmm. came along, what was the change that evidently helped Steve tremendously? Were there new drugs developed that you talked about 10 years of treatment with older drugs, and then you came
Steve
to a point?
Steve is one of the fortunate people who has had a good response to one of the medicines that we talk of as the second generation medicines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, truthfully, The side effects of the second generation medicines are more tolerable than the first generation medicines. And it's wonderful that people do well on them. But again, in terms of cure rates, the second generation medications are no better than the first generation medications.
Mm.
But Steve is someone who really exemplifies a life lived in recovery. So he has not denied his mental illness. He's been very responsible in dealing with it. But, you know, what is this notion of recovery? And something that I always come back to, a simple-minded, there was an administrator of the the big federal agency that oversees behavioral health, a guy named Charlie Curie. I don't know if you knew Charlie.
Yeah, I know him, yeah.
And Charlie said this thing that has stuck in my mind when he's explaining what recovery is. He said, well, recovery is simple. It's a decent job, a place called home, and a date on Saturday night. Right?
And what was the last one?
A decent job, a place called home, and a date on Saturday night. And it's, you know, it's what we all want. It's,
right. Steve, you've done a tremendous amount of work to raise awareness, and that gets to the point that I wanted to also address briefly, the stigma that has dissipated. It's still there. We know it's still there. But speak to that. When you were first diagnosed in the 1979, the early 80s, did you come against against attitudes that were just leave me alone?
Yeah, very much so. You know, because like when I meet somebody new, it's not the first thing you tell them. Oh yeah, I have this mental illness. But anyway, sometimes they'll dig around a little bit, try to find out what you do, and I may eventually, if I'm comfortable, say, you know, yeah, I have mental health issues. And sometimes that person will turn and walk away right away.
To this day. Yes.
Even people I've known for a while, but maybe didn't know I had mental health issues.
But more commonly, I'm sure you're also saying, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Who doesn't have mental health issues?
Open any door. Open any door. I mean, they may not be the kinds of mental health issues that you have.
Right.
And there is the broad spectrum of mental illnesses and their severity. But, you know, I think there's broad recognition that these are not uncommon, conditions.
So on the other hand, even though some people still stigmatize, on the other hand, some people, when they hear mental health, that click into them, you know, they have a friend or a family member or somebody they know. So they want to find more out about you.
And that's a positive response. I was going to ask that. Yeah. So what if I'm sitting across from somebody at a cafe or in a school, I've just met them, and you tell me that mental health has been a struggle for you. For me, to show interest is a good response.
I think so.
Yeah. It's to show interest. And like you would say with any Dr. Flaumt, with any other sort of malady, that you would say, oh, tell me more about it, because they obviously want to tell you if they've mentioned it.
Yeah, I think that's true. But also not to, you know, one thing that's a part of recovery is person-first language. Mm. So I used to work with someone, and she would correct me when I would say a person is a schizophrenic. She would correct me.
You mean person with schizophrenia?
And it used to drive me nuts. I thought, God, this is politically correct crap. Mm-hmm. Until I understood what she was talking about, which is we are all many things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So maybe I am a person with diabetes. Maybe I am a person who suffers from alcoholism. Maybe I am a person who has, X, Y, or Z. But that is not all of who I am. So if I happen to have schizophrenia, I'm a person who has schizophrenia, but I also have this, that, and the other thing.
Okay. Let's try to get one caller in. Michael calling from Iowa City. Not much time, Michael, but do you have a personal connection to our theme, mental health, then and now?
Yes, I do. I was diagnosed with depression, ADHD, other mental health issues about 12 years ago, and going off of the stigma comment raised earlier, because of that stigma, family members and friends, loved ones, often don't know how to respond, how to react when someone they know comes out and says, okay, I have this mental illness, and I need help. Can you help me somehow? And people just don't recognize what a big deal mental illness is until it affects someone they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do as a society to help educate people on how to react and respond to someone with mental illness?
That's a great question, Michael.
That's a good question. And what do we do? How do we treat people is interesting. You know, like I said, I think it's okay to be open if you're comfortable and it's a low-risk situation. As far as society goes, it's got a ways to go yet. We've made some really good strides, but there is still a long ways to go.
And Steve, I know you've been a great spokesperson, national spokesperson for NAMI. And so the works, the walks that are every year. Mm-hmm. When we talk about, from a medical point of view, Dr. Flom, the attitudes that society has, that your friends, your family, your neighbors have around you, what part does that play in this idea of recovery?
I think it plays a big idea. Actually, one of the interesting epidemiological findings is that it seemed like people in third world nations had better outcomes with psychosis. And people wondered about that. One theory is that it was not seen as necessarily something outside of the culture. It was more accepted as just a part of the culture.
So, one variant in the culture.
Yeah. That's the way it should be.
And not shunned or put away. Very quickly, we don't have much time left, but you are a psychiatrist, Dr. Flom. But how have we evolved in terms of behavioral therapy and drugs? Where have we come there? Can you sum up that quickly?
Yeah, I think I'll try to be quick, which is that the very good notion that these are indeed medical illnesses and have to be treated as such, which started coming up in the 60s and 70s, was, I think, unfortunately co-opted in the 80s and 90s to these are chemical imbalances, and the only thing we can do to treat them is give the right chemicals. And we narrowed our view of what it would take to be helpful to medicine. Medicine plays an important role, but that is all it plays. It is one piece of what it takes to recover. And I think one of the nice things that has happened over the last decade or so is pulling back from this narrow-minded view that if we get the meds right, everything else is going to fall into place. That is not the case. Mm-hmm. The meds are a piece of it. There's a whole lot else.
We've got about a minute left. Can you tell us, in your personal experience, Steve, meds and therapy, those go hand in hand?
I think everything you can possibly do to help you. Get a good treatment team around you. Get good people. Do what you can to help yourself. As far as the brain and being injured, and I always think that when you have an episode or it goes through serious psychosis, it takes the brain time to heal like any other muscle it would.
Yeah.
So just hang in there, give it some time, and there's good hope.
Okay, good. Perhaps people listening to this conversation will want to know, you know, where to start. You start with your general physician. If you have questions of somebody in your family, you yourself are just having some difficulties, you want to get some answers, start with your good old doctor and go from there. Or online, can you find information as well?
There's tons of information online, and NAMI is a good source of information.
The National Alliance for Mental Illness.
National Alliance on Mental Illness.
On Mental Illness. You go there. There is a lot of information there, too.
We are celebrating that first week of October as Mental Illness Awareness Week, and there's going to be several events in the area.
Okay. Check that out with the NAMI website. We've run out of time. Dr. Michael Flom, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. Steve Miller, thanks for coming in and sharing your story of mental illness so that others can feel a bit freer, better talking about theirs in certain situations. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure.
When we come back, we want to explore more of our theme, then and now. We'll talk about the then and now of the battle against childhood diseases, infectious diseases. That's when we return. It's Iowa Week here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week on our talk shows, both on this show, River to River, and on Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe at 10 o'clock. Chance for us to pick up a theme and run with it in various scenarios. Our theme this week, then and now. So it's kind of like a looking glass. You pick up the then and now looking glass, and we're looking at, law enforcement. Yesterday, we were looking at jobs, for instance. Last half hour, mental illness, how it was understood and treated. then versus now. This half hour, we want to explore how the battle against childhood diseases has changed over the decades. And there have been momentous changes in the field of infectious disease prevention in the past 70 to 80 years. Joining us to give us an overview and help us understand some of the big changes, Dr. Nate Price is with us of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics and specializes in pediatric infectious diseases. Dr. Price, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back a few generations to the days when childhood diseases were really something feared by all parents and kids, and they were treated much less effectively than they are today. What era would you like to take us back to?
Sure. There's a story I like to tell about there's a place called Lee's Ferry in Arizona. I grew up in Arizona, and it was a place where people would ford across the river to come into Arizona and settle. And back in the 1800s, there was a family that would live there, and they would basically work the ferry. And so one night, this family that was coming to cross stayed the night with them, and then the next morning went across and then went their way down in, I think, towards Tuba City. Well, that family had actually buried one of their children back on the trail a few days prior. So it turns out that child had diphtheria, and that family that hosted them that did the ferry, was doing the ferry, their family got diphtheria. So in the course of about a week and a half, about four children of that family died of diphtheria. And diphtheria was a horrible disease. You know, the toxin would make your heart do funny things. But the real problem was is you would get this membrane going across your tonsils and you'd basically choke to death. So seven of these children got this disease and four of them died in the course of about a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it was a terrible time to have those types of diseases, and they really had nothing they could do about them.
When you go back a few generations, approximately, I don't know, 70, 80, 90, 100 years or whatever, what are the big ones that were faced? You mentioned diphtheria. What other infectious diseases are parents really scared of, families scared of?
Yeah, so, I mean, probably a little bit around that time, too, smallpox was a major issue. And so smallpox would come through the community, and if you hadn't gotten smallpox, then you would probably get it, and about a third of people who got smallpox died.
Mm.
And so, you know, fortunately, Edward Jenner, back in the, you know, late 1700s, figured out that milkmaids who had gotten a similar disease to smallpox on their fingers would actually be protected against getting smallpox later on. And so he figured out if you could take that infection and give it to people through vaccination, they would be protected. And so that was kind of the birth of the modern vaccine era.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's one of the huge success stories in you know, modern history, is that smallpox is not around anymore. You know, the only places we have smallpox are in a few laboratories under lock and key, because no one else has it anymore. We got rid of it off of the face of the earth, effectively.
When we talk about horrible childhood diseases of the past, we have to talk about polio. Thankfully, in the middle part of the 20th century, a vaccine was developed. It was understood, and that disease is no longer with us, to my knowledge. Does it exist? Is it around?
Yeah, there are parts of the world where polio still exists.
Really?
It's mostly because we can't get the vaccine into those areas. It's war-torn areas. It's poor areas. But fortunately, we don't have polio in the United States anymore because of the vaccines.
We wanted to talk with an Iowan who is a polio survivor in just a minute. But Dr. Price, give us an overview of this disease. This is a virus that strikes and does what?
Yeah, so poliovirus is a virus. It was usually around the summertime. You could get it by basically touching something that had it and then putting that in your mouth. In the mouth, it would, you know, get into your gastrointestinal tract. And most people who got polio actually wouldn't have any symptoms at all. But some people, you know, a select few, would get paralytic disease. And sometimes the paralysis would be short-lived, but for a lot of people, the paralysis was lifelong. And you've probably heard of things like the iron lung, where people basically were paralyzed from the neck down and had to be in this large machine to help them breathe, and that's kind of how they lived out their life.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Price, Jane Lovell is also with us, a resident of rural Scranton, Iowa. Jane joining us by phone. Hi, Jane. That's in West Central Iowa where you live?
Yes, it is.
Hi.
Green County, where it got so wet just Sunday night.
All right. So you survived polio. Tell us your story. What year are we talking that? How old were you in what year when you started to feel symptoms?
I just started second grade at country school and was living where I'm living now on the same farm.
What year?
1950.
Yeah,
so before the vaccine.
Right. The 1955, I believe, the vaccine came into being, thankfully. What did you start feeling? What were your first symptoms?
Well, I remember starting to feel sick, and I don't have a timeline on this. It's now getting to be a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, and I don't know whether it was my first visit to the doctor we doctored with in Jefferson or whether it was a second one, but they sent my parents with me on from Jefferson straight down to the old Blank Children's Hospital. It was part of Methodist Hospital. And I don't know whether the doctor suspected polio. My guess in hindsight is he did, and I don't know whether he told my parents that, but we went straight down, and I was admitted to the old Blank Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that word? Do you have an early memory of hearing the word polio?
I don't know that I remember about polio until I had it.
Mm-hmm.
But as a 7.5-year-old living in rural Iowa, you know, wouldn't have been all over the television because we didn't have that. And I just don't remember that I knew much about it prior to getting it.
As Dr. Price mentioned, the majority of people who are infected with the polio virus can, you know, maybe have a few symptoms or no symptoms at all and do not experience what you experience. What did you experience in terms of the paralysis that Dr. Price mentioned?
I ended up with braces on both legs fastened together at the middle, and it affected my left arm, maybe my shoulder more than actually my arm. And when I was dismissed from the hospital after rehabilitation exercises and what have you, the following 1st of May, I continued to wear the one-leg brace with still the band around the middle. They'd taken the one off of my right leg. And I continue to wear a brace till today and now use crutches more than I used to because of balance. But I learned to walk using crutches and with two straight leg braces, which is a bit of a challenge, especially when they want you to go upstairs.
Right. So even today, you have a lasting impairment from polio.
Almost definitely.
Mm-hmm. What has actually happened in those muscles? They've deteriorated. Why don't they recover fully, usually, Dr. Price?
Yeah, so the virus affects a specific part in the spinal cord, actually. So the messages basically aren't getting from the brain to the muscles. And so over time, you know, if muscles aren't used, and they also atrophy from disuse and don't work anymore.
Mm-hmm. Did you, for instance, Jane Lovell, have any sort of support for you? Were there such things as support groups for people who had polio?
No, we just went on with our lives the best we could, I think.
Yeah, you did.
I probably had a number of years that I wouldn't have had a contact with anybody else that had polio, or if they'd had polio and it left no signs. Now, somebody would know with me, they might wonder why I wore a brace, or especially in the winter at one time was when I would use crutches, and somebody might wonder about that. But by and large, if I knew somebody else that had polio, it was just a happenstance, and we might not have even discussed polio.
Oh, really? There was no help in sort of being together?
The help finally came when people started in the 80s, when people started having post-polio syndrome, late effects of polio, whichever term you choose.
Dr. Price, what is that?
I honestly don't know enough about polio and its effects later in age to tell you the truth.
Jane Lovell, tell us, what is that? Do you know? What is your understanding?
They aren't quite sure, and there's not really a definitive test.
Okay.
But if you've got a past history with polio and you start to develop things like new weakness, some people had pain. I'm fortunate I rarely have that. Or you have fatigue. And for people that had breathing issues, they've ended up with some real problems. But I didn't have bulbar, and I never was in an iron lung, although I do remember there being on the floor I was on when I was recovering and getting rehabilitated. There was somebody in an iron lung, and it was kind of – it's one of those things, if you ever see one and somebody's in it, I doubt you would forget.
No, I don't think you would. Very, very scary. But you said you never had to spend time in one?
No, No, that was never my issue or problem.
Jane Lovell is with us, sharing her memories of being a polio survivor. She lives now in West Central Iowa. Dr. Nate Price specializes in pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. When we take this subset of children that is covered by pediatrics, of course, how does that present itself as a unique and significant subgroup to guard against infectious diseases? How do you approach that subgroup differently than, say, you would adults?
So, you know, children are a great group because they're resilient in general, but they're also a very vulnerable group, you know, and so they're not able to advocate for themselves, and so you have to have someone who's got their interests in mind. And so, you know, sometimes their issues can fall by the wayside unless you have someone who's really taking up that cause. And fortunately, people have done that through the years, but there's certainly a group that needs special consideration. The other thing is, you've got someone who, if you have the chance to intervene and make a difference, you can make a difference for a huge period of time for the rest of their life. And, I'm not saying it's not a good thing to help someone who's towards the end of their life, because I think all people that are suffering need to be helped, but you can make such a difference in a small child. And if you can cure something or prevent something, you have so much more time that they can go on and live their lives and be happy and do great things.
Mm-hmm. Jane, how would your life, do you think at all about how your life would have been different had your body reacted differently to the polio virus, or you had not come in contact with the virus at all?
That's a real good question, and you can think about it, but it's like lots of things. There's no way to go back and really do it differently. I think there might have been things that would have been better, but there might have been some things that wouldn't have been so. And I was fortunate that I had a really supportive family, too. My mother did a lot of helping me with exercises, learning how to do those after I was released, just before I was actually released from the hospital. And I can remember having my braces would be made in Des Moines, and I would have, back then we usually, our doctors when we were dealing with our polio tended to be orthopedic surgeons, and now most of us are more likely to see a physiatrist if we see a specialist, and they're the rehabilitation medicine people.
Mm-hmm. Jane, to what degree were you quarantined when it was diagnosed?
Okay, went down to Blank Children's Hospital, and we were isolated on the bottom floor, and our parents weren't allowed to come in down there, except the first room I was in, there was a girl in there, don't remember much of anything about them, where they were from or anything. I was, about that time, I was being really ill, and it was like flu-like symptoms at the time, but her mother was there, and as I recall, she was there because this gal, maybe about my age, was in critical condition, and her mother was very good to me, as I recall. Don't have any idea who they were, where they were from, and I don't think my parents got to come in to see me until I was moved upstairs and was in rehabilitation, and then you could come visit every afternoon, except my parents lived a little more than an hour away, and that didn't always, they didn't try to come every day. I also, at the time, had a three-year-old sister, and my dad had a farm, and there was livestock, and there were things that needed to get done.
A lot of hard work yet to do, even with one member of the family very sick. Dr. Price, as we consider then and now, to what degree have we conquered these dangerous childhood viruses and bacteria?
So we've made huge progress. You know, there. You look at all these things that we're vaccinating for, and we very rarely see them anymore. You know, I talk to people that are training these days, and if we ever even have a case of chickenpox, chickenpox was common. You know, most children by the time they hit adulthood in the U.S. had gotten chickenpox.
I sure had it.
Exactly, me too. And if we get a new case and there are people learning, like residents or medical students, I make sure I get them all there because they're probably not going to see a case in the next 10 to 15 years because we've done so well with our chickenpox vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so, we don't see people getting polio anymore in the U.S. We don't see congenital rubella syndrome anymore. You know, I had one case of a baby that died a couple of years ago of congenital rubella syndrome, and that was from a mother who came from a different country who didn't get a rubella vaccine. And so these are things we just don't see anymore. And And it's a good thing. You know, it's difficult if it shows up because we don't have the experience we used to have, but that's a good thing because, you know, there's so many people that aren't getting these things and either dying for them from them or being permanently maimed from them.
So what are the biggest challenges now? Do we have bacteria, viruses that are resistant to the drugs? Is that one of the challenges?
Yeah. So, you know, certainly there are still plenty of things out there that we can target to try to prevent in the future. But I think one of the major issues that we're having now is that, you know, we're using lots of antibiotics, you know, both in, you know, people and in animals. And the more we use them, the more these bacteria get exposed to antibiotics. And so the more they get exposed to them, then the more chance they have to become resistant to them. And so it's a real problem in some places. You get these multi-drug resistant bacteria that we kind of run out of options for. Mm-hmm. And so you're using antibiotics that have lots of bad side effects in people, and sometimes they cause more harm than good.
Mm-hmm. A child born today will have how many vaccinations over the course of, let's say, the first 5 or 10 years? What would you say? Can you list them all?
Put me on the spot. So we've got – the nice thing is we've got combination vaccines now. And so we actually have more things that we vaccinate for in this day and age than we did even 20 years ago. The interesting thing is that we actually have fewer antigens in there. Antigens are what we expose the body to that looks like the actual infection. So even though we have more things we vaccinate for, we have fewer antigens. And the nice thing is we combine them into vaccines. So we have DTaP, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. We have hepatitis B, and we have polio vaccine. That's a combination vaccine right there. We have Haemophilus influenza type B that can cause meningitis. And, you know, when you talk about that one, the people that I trained with who are, you know, 20 years older than me, they talk about the glory days of meningitis where every night there would be somebody new in the hospital with meningitis, bacterial meningitis from things like pneumococcus or Haemophilus influenza.
The glory days in terms of they could study that person.
In glory days as in the bacteria was living large. And, you know,
bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And fortunately, we don't see that anymore. I've never seen a case of Haemophilus influenza type B meningitis because of this vaccine. And so, you know, lots of other vaccines. MMR is another one. Rotavirus is another one. All these are vaccines that we give in the first year or two of life.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, doctor, on the anti-vaccination movement as someone who... a doctor who specializes in pediatric infectious diseases, this movement that blames modern vaccinations, you've listed off a number of the combination ones, blames them for a wide range of health problems.
So it's tough because on the one hand, you don't want to tell people what they absolutely have to do. You know, I totally understand freedom. And I understand, too, that sometimes religion comes into play, you know, and I'm all for religious freedom. But... you know, I think a lot of the problem is there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Specifically?
And so, you know, the whole problem that was really got things into the news and I think really drove a lot of the fear early on was this potential link between autism and the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, measles in particular. And, you know, the studies that did – there was one person who did a study and it really was a very poorly designed study. It really didn't answer the question and it was really poorly done and there are a lot of ethical issues with it. And over and over and over again, people have looked at that, weren't able to reproduce it and have actually really disproven that theory. But because of that, there was a lot of fear. And so that, I think, drove some of that. But again, that's at this point in time, I think people have pretty well debunked that. But that misinformation still is out there. So
are you saying that there, with modern vaccinations, there is no risk to a healthy child?
No, that's not true. There is always some risk. You know, no medicine, no intervention, no vaccine's perfect. So the oral polio vaccine was actually a really good example of that. So people who got the oral polio vaccine, it was a live virus, but they had tweaked it to where it wouldn't cause polio usually. But I think the number was like 1 in 2 million people who got it could still get paralysis. We figured out after we were getting rid of regular polio in the U.S., we figured out that a few people every year were getting paralysis because of the vaccine. But fortunately, science had figured that out and had gotten an inactivated vaccine that didn't cause that. So we switched over. And so, yes, we caused some harm, but we had huge benefit from that. Mm-hmm. And so we switched over. Science figured it out, switched over to something else that didn't cause that harm.
Jane Lovell, in the minute or so we have remaining, very, very quickly, what do you think of the anti-vaccination movement when you hear about it?
I often wonder if the parents of those children have ever been around somebody who had, like I do, polio, because I had every vaccine there was. but it just hadn't come out in time for me. But I did take the vaccine because I hadn't had bulbar polio, and I've been thankful over the years that it was there for my siblings and my daughter and others. My heart goes out to people in other countries that are still having polio, because our world in the United States may not be perfect as far as helping people with disabilities and being accessible, but it's better than way most of the world.
Very good. Very quickly, Dr. Price, the future challenges that you face as a pediatric infectious disease specialist?
So, you know, there's always something on the horizon, fortunately, that people are looking into and figuring out. So I think we've got, you know, lots of progress here. We've got new antibiotics people are trying to figure out, new antivirals, and new vaccines. There's, you know, still a fair amount of disease out there that I think that we have the ability to make progress and prevent.
Okay. Dr. Nate Price, Clinical Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and a specialist in infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thanks for taking the time to come to our Iowa City studio, Doctor.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Jane Lovell, thank you for sharing your personal story of being a polio survivor, a resident of rural Scranton in West Central Iowa. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, we continue Iowa Week tomorrow. Of course, usually Politics Day on Wednesday. We will incorporate that into our theme. We're going to talk about political discourse then and now. We like to decry the state of political discourse these days. Many of us do anyway. Was it any better in the past? We'll ask that question tomorrow. We go back 100 years to ask that question. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Coming up next, it's Here and Now from NPR News and WBUR. All this week on Here and Now, prescription, opioid, and heroin epidemic. We'll hear from a family that's lost two sons to addiction, from a doctor trying to get fellow doctors to prescribe fewer opiates, and from a police chief who is pledging help, not arrest, for addicts. That's coming up next on Here and Now. It's Iowa Public Radio, 1259.
Support comes from Adamantine Spine Moving, a locally owned, socially responsible mover, offering full-service green moves down the block or across the country. Adamantine Spine Moving, funny name, serious about doing good, on the web at spinemoving.com. Support comes from Paul McAndrew, looking out for the injured worker for over 26 years and joining others in support of public radio. Paul McAndrew Law Firm, with offices in Coralville, or online at paulmcandrew.com.
Local, national, and international news and information programming. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio News, WSUI 910 AM Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and KRNI 1010 AM Mason City, Clear Lake. Hear Iowa Public Radio's 24-hour news service online and find news stories, podcasts, program schedules, and more at our website, iowapublicradio.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Germany says it can accept 500,000 migrants a year, but what will they do when they get there?
Also, when a mom's first son died of a heroin overdose, she didn't mention it in his obituary. When her second son died, she did, and invited the newspaper to the funeral.
I felt like they write about it all the time, and I invited them to come in and feel it. That was my mission that day, and I said that to them. Look, come in and feel it.
And gun violence in Chicago. A Southside pastor tells us why the city's seeing the highest homicide rate in years.
You know, there's a saying in our neighborhood that snitches get stitches, and we have to talk to the police, because if we don't, it's going to continue to escalate and get worse.
Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Nearly a week after she was ordered to jail for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, Rowan County